This interview is with General Earl G. Wheeler, and today is Thursday, August 21st, 1969. We are in General Wheeler's office as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon, and this is Dorothy Pierce McSweeney. General, I would like to just briefly note your commands before we begin, because I feel this is the time period central to our area of discussion. I have down here in 1960 to 1962 that you were director of the Joint Staff Organization within the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This would be here at the Pentagon.
That's correct.
In 1962, you were Deputy Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. European Command. Then from 62 to 64, Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army. In 1964, you were nominated and confirmed as Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
That's correct.
Before we go into your associations with Lyndon Johnson, I would like to ask if you've participated in any other oral history project.
I participated in an oral history project that was conducted after the assassination of President Kennedy regarding my relationship with President Kennedy during the time that he was president, and also the one or two contacts I had with him during his campaign for the presidency.
That would have been primarily as Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army, wouldn't it?
That is correct.
All right. For that reason, scholars can refer to that transcript. We will sort of skip over some of the military developments of that period. And I would like to ask you first, when you met Mr. Johnson, and did you have any contact with him during his Senate years?
I didn't meet President Johnson during the time he was in the Senate. I was out of the country in Europe most of the time, and during the 3 years that I was here, late 1955 to late 1958, I was on the Army staff, but my area of interest was such that there was no reason for me to have any contact with Senator Johnson. I testified before the subcommittee of the Senate Preparedness Investigating Committee on a couple of occasions on airlift, but that subcommittee was headed by Senator Symington, or chaired by Senator Symington, not by Senator Johnson. So the first time I met him, really, was socially after he was elected Vice President in 1960. Assumed the office of Vice President in 1961. The first official meeting that I had with him occurred, I think, in early 1961, when President Kennedy was out of the country. And we had a flap over a weekend having to do with Haiti, as I recall. There was a meeting convened at State, and I went to it representing the Joint Staff. I was in the director of the Joint Staff, of the organization of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Vice President Johnson attended this meeting. It was really the first time I'd ever seen him in action, and I was very much struck by one characteristic which I saw him display thereafter on many occasions. Namely, he insisted that if we decided to take any action, political or military, that there should first be consultation with the congressional leadership. Thereafter, I had very little contact with him, except again on a couple of social occasions, until I became Chief of Staff of the Army on 1 October 1962. even then, when I attended from time to time National Security Council meetings along with the other chiefs, I had very little personal contact with then Vice President Johnson. I would say that my contacts began with President Johnson when he appointed me as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on 3 July 1964. And of course, increasingly, during the remainder of his tenure in office, I saw him more and more frequently as the tempo of the war in Southeast Asia increased, and as the problems connected with it got to be more and more sizable.
General, we've come to the point in time of your appointment. Could you tell me a little bit about this? I have a notation here that this really represented the end of the rotation precedent among the services, although it had, you had your prior, your two previous predecessors as chairman were from the Army. This was...
Well, you could consider it a break in precedent or not, depending upon how you break out the time periods. By law, the chairman can be appointed for two-year terms in time of peace. Now, General Lemnitzer, who was my predecessor but one, succeeded General Nate Twining, who of the Air Force, who served almost 4 years. Now, General Twining retired only a few months before he would have completed 4 years as the chairman. As I say, Lem only served 2 years, then went to Europe to replace General Lawrence Norstad, whose deputy I was in Europe. And General Maxwell D. Taylor was called back from retirement, actually had been called back before, was acting as the president's military advisor. And he was appointed as chairman on the same day that I was appointed chief of staff of the Army, on October 62. So you might consider it was General Taylor who broke the precedent. Then when General Taylor was asked to become our ambassador to South Vietnam, the president and Secretary McNamara selected me to replace General Taylor. So maybe I broke the precedent, I'm just not sure.
Was there any consultation among the services to find out how they would feel about your appointment?
I doubt it. Normally, certainly not on the military level. The Joint Chiefs of Staff pass upon the appointments of all 3- and 4-star officers, as you may know. This is an understanding that President Eisenhower made with the Senate Armed Services Committee. However, the Joint Chiefs of Staff considered it inappropriate for them to comment on who should be appointed the chief of the service or who should be appointed the chairman. Now, whether Mr. McNamara or President Johnson talked to the service secretaries, I don't know.
Has Mr. Johnson ever commented to you about how your name was proposed to him? This position?
I think it was probably proposed by two people, Secretary McNamara and General Taylor. This would be my guess. But he never really said.
I'd like to deal in this first part of the interview briefly with the types of communication and decision-making process between the Joint Chiefs and the President or the White House. And first, I'd like to ask you what the channels of communication are between you and the White House.
Well, in the first place, by law, the Joint Chiefs of Staff are, as a body, of the military advisors to the President, the National Security Council, and the Secretary of Defense. We convey our advice to the President in several ways. One, we prepare formal papers which go to the Secretary of Defense. From time to time, why we will have as the last paragraph something which says the Joint Chiefs of Staff desire or the Joint Chiefs of Staff recommend that this paper be forwarded to the President for his information. Secondly, from time to time, President Johnson would meet with all of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, this was a practice that was followed also by preceding presidents, also by Mr. Nixon. But, for example, before we put the budget to bed, there's always a meeting of the President with the Secretary of Defense and all the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. President Johnson used to have these meetings down at the ranch, normally, sometime during early or mid-December, depending upon the agenda and the calendars of the various principals involved. Then on other occasions, he would ask all of the chiefs to attend a National Security Council meeting. On two or three occasions, President Johnson would have what I would call a more informal meeting with the Joint Chiefs and have us all over to lunch with the Secretary of Defense. However, as time went on and the business, particularly the war in Southeast Asia, as I referred to earlier, got hotter, generally it was I who spoke to the other chiefs. This is just a matter of convenience. In other words, trying to get five people around the table and so on is rather burdensome from a logistic point of view, if nothing else. So as time went on, as I say, his custom became to have me attend all of the meetings that had anything to do with military business. This would be cabinet meetings, National Security Council meetings. And then when Walt Rostow became the Special Assistant for National Security Affairs, President Johnson started, the so-called Tuesday luncheons, which I always attended. I was one of the regular invitees. Now, the people that attended these luncheons, of course, the President, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Helms, the Director of Central for Central Intelligence, myself, Walt Rostow. In addition, from time to time, Mr. Clifford would attend. He was then the chairman of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, but he was also an advisor to the President on many other things. They've been friends for many years. From time to time, Mr. Justice Fortas would attend the luncheon. From time to time, this was after General Taylor returned from being ambassador, or retired as ambassador in South Vietnam, General Taylor would attend. The President would wanted his advice on matters political and military, particularly political having to do with South Vietnam. Then quite frequently, George Christian, the press secretary, would be there, and also Tom Johnson or somebody like that to take notes. Occasionally, Vice President Humphrey would attend, but these occasions were usually when matters of legislative or political nature were being discussed. Now these luncheons were very interesting affairs because the the range of problems discussed was not confined to the military at all, but went right across the full spectrum of areas of presidential interest at the time. Generally, though, there would be at least some military or military security matters involved. Now, on those occasions, I mentioned cabinet meetings, National Security Council meetings, special meetings of various kinds in the cabinet room with small groups of his advisors, and these Tuesday luncheons. I would put forward the military point of view when this was necessary, or comment on anything else as far as that goes. Mr. Johnson didn't confine me to commenting on military affairs at all.
General, could you comment on these various types of meetings that you've mentioned, from cabinet meetings to the National Security Council to the Tuesday luncheons, as to their regularity and as to their being a decision-making body?
The President Johnson didn't really use the cabinet meetings as a decision-making apparatus. It was there that he discussed problems with his with the members of his cabinet, got their viewpoints on various programs, found out what progress is being made in various programs, and so on. I'm not trying to indicate that no decisions ever came out of these. I'm sure they did, because the record was always kept, of course, and I'm sure that Mr. Johnson, being the kind of man he is, why this stuff kept churning around in his head, it eventually turned into decisions. National Security Council meetings, yes. They were smaller, of course, because usually you would have the statutory members of the NSC present. Generally speaking, we were dealing in problems having to do with national security interests. And before Mr. Johnson would make a decision, for example, in such a thing as putting troops in the Dominican Republic, he always had a meeting of the National Security Council and got the views of the membership. Now, the Tuesday luncheons, I think, became more and more a decision-making forum as time went on. President Johnson, as you no doubt know, likes to get the views of any number of people before he makes a decision. It was nothing unusual at all for him to say, well, now I called so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so last night. These would be people all around the country, just taking their pulse, you see, to find out what their reaction was to this situation or that situation. He's a great telephone user, so President Kennedy, I might add. And he liked to get a number of views. He was a good question asker. His method of doing business was contrary to that of President Kennedy, who liked to see things in writing. He read very fast. He absorbed things quickly by writing, in writing. President Johnson preferred to use, I imagine, the system that he developed when he was the majority leader on the Hill, of getting people in a small, smoke-filled room and boring into a subject until he had picked your brains and I suppose, examined all of the facets of the problem before he would make up his mind to do something. Now, I mentioned other decision-making times. I mentioned earlier the fact that I've been first struck by his insistence that before anything was done, there should be consultation with the congressional leadership. Invariably, throughout the time he was president, before any major decision was made, such as going into the Dominican public, or such as the Tonkin Gulf affair, or such as putting our troops into South Vietnam, he would always have a meeting with the congressional leadership. He would have them briefed, told what the situation was, what the options were that were available to us, and then he would seek the counsel of the various senators and congressmen present. And they usually had a pretty good turnout. So, in a sense, you might say this was a decision-making process in itself, although, of course, it was President Johnson who made the decision. Everybody else's words were in the nature of counsel of one way or kind or another, either negative or affirmative. But in the end, well, he would make up his mind to go ahead and do so-and-so.
Reflectively about on these meetings, you are saying that they were consultative. It was not just a matter of posing the question and the decision being announced.
No, I know that on a number of occasions, President Johnson was accused of not really consulting with the Congress, that they were, in effect, informed. I think that's an oversimplification and an injustice to President Johnson. His long service in the Congress had taught him, I think, that before you took any major step that had sizable political implications, that it would be a good idea to touch base with the principal political leaders in the country, certainly the leadership of the Congress. And I'm speaking now of both bodies and of both parties, the Democratic and the Republican. For example, you always have Senator Mansfield, Senator Dirksen, Senator Dick Russell, Stennis, Margaret Chase Smith, and others, Carl Hayden when he was still around, and Senator Fulbright. And on the House side, he would always have, of course, the Speaker, Jerry Ford, Wendell Rivers, Doc Morgan, usually the chairman of the House Appropriations Subcommittee, Phelps. From Texas, I don't like this.
Price.
No.
We'll fill it in.
Mayhon.
Oh, George Mayhon.
George Mayhon.
Among others, Carl Albert would usually be there, and others of the, you might call, the leadership.
General, with the emergence of more dovish opinions among the congressional body, was there any lessening of consultation with them?
No.
Of course, I'm thinking predominantly
really,
of Senator,
really,
of Senator
Fulbright. You see, the major decisions were the decisions having to do with the Dominican Republic, which was supported very fully by the congressional leadership. The Tonkin Gulf retaliation, which again was supported, the legislation was introduced by Senator Fulbright. The placing of our own ground troops into Vietnam, not only speaking of when we put the Marines in to protect the Da Nang Air Base, but on July the 25th, 65, when the President decided to introduce a sizable number of ground troops. He consulted on all of these occasions, and many others. Now, for example, generally when I took one of my rather frequent trips to Southeast Asia, when I came back, he would perhaps have him come to breakfast, and he'd have congressional leaders at the breakfast, and I would brief them on what I had seen on my trip, my estimate of the situation, and so on. In addition to that, he, from time to time, scheduled in the evenings what I would call a rather formal briefings for large numbers of the Congress. As a matter of fact, he made the effort in a series of these evening briefings to brief the entire Congress on the situation and so on. When I say brief the entire Congress, it would cover the whole spectrum. You'd have Secretary Rusk speak, you would have Secretary McNamara speak, I would speak, and Mr. Helms, and be open to questions after. In other words, he was trying to present there, I think, not so much indulge in a consultative process as in an educational process, so as to sway the opinion in the Congress, which of course is causing him a great deal of trouble.
Were these as frequent in 1968 as they were in 65, 66, 67?
I would say that in 68, no. 67, 66 were the two years where these were held the most frequent.
General, as a principal military advisor to the president, which is, I think, your constitutional duty in this aspect, how would you assess the president's reception of military advice throughout this period?
Well, when President Johnson became president, I think he was somewhat suspicious of the military. In other words, he really had no military orientation in his past. He had served for a while, of course, in World War II, in the Navy, I believe. But, of course, when he was on the Hill, he was a member or the head of committees which dealt with the military. But basically speaking, he hadn't had any wide acquaintanceship or dealings with the military, except in the budget process or something like that. And I think that he was inclined to believe that we would be somewhat more parochial than we are, and perhaps somewhat less objective than I think we are usually. This may be a function of the fact that President Johnson very much likes to deal with people he knows. At least this is one of the characteristics that I found in him. And as he got to know me better, there was no question in my mind, but he was far more receptive to my ideas and my proposals than he was at the outset. Also, I think he went through a growth process once we really got enmeshed in this war. His instincts are not in any way militaristic or, on the contrary, as you probably know, his focus had always been on domestic affairs, not on foreign affairs or military security affairs, really, although he had some dealings in them. However, as time went on, as he studied more and more what happens in wars and how wars are fought, he came to have a pretty good appreciation of the use of force and power. Of course, he's always understood the use of power, but he was talking now political power, but I think he came to understand more clearly how the political and the military fit together, foreign policy and military. military power fit together. So that as time went on, I felt that my relationships with President Johnson became closer and warmer over the months.
It exceeded the official capacity, didn't it? You met many times.
Oh, yes.
Just informally with Mr. Johnson, I believe.
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, we invited to the ranch, among other things, it was Wheeler and myself. And he started calling me by my nickname. Only he called him Buzz, not Bus, but that's neither here nor there. Yes, it came to be a friendly relationship over time. That is, as friendly as a president can ever be with anybody else. There are limits.
In these really unofficial type of meetings, what were the topics of, the range of topics of discussion, General?
Everything. But you've got to recognize that being the type of man he is, and with the problems that he had pressing down on him, that very generally, even though it was not a formal occasion or a briefing or something, he was talking about the problems that we were faced with, including, however, the problems that were posed in the country by dissidents, crime, that sort of thing. I mean, very wide-ranging. And, of course, you know, his fascination with his grandchildren and so forth, that sometimes came up for discussion, too.
Did you see a change in the president's mood over the period, and this would be from a personal standpoint?
Oh, yes. His last 2 years in office, he aged very perceptibly and quite rapidly. He has a tremendous amount of energy, as you no doubt know, but he was a tired man. He was tired mentally, if not physically, and I think maybe he was a little tired spiritually, too, toward the end. He felt very keenly, and it had its effect on him, his loss of popularity in the country. This is something that bothered him a great deal. He's a very sensitive man, and although some people don't think so, he is. And, so he felt this rather sharply, and I think it was reflected in his physical appearance and in his actions.
General, this is a little off in another direction, but as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, this is related to military advice, was it generally the method to have you, I think you've mentioned that you've, towards the end, were representing the other chiefs of staff, was this on the basis of having arrived at a consensus opinion before presenting it to the president?
Yes.
Or were members... Could members act individually?
You've got to remember that by law, any member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has the right to see the president. In other words, he just says, I want to see the president, and he gets to see the president. The normal method is to tell the Secretary of Defense that I want to see the president, and that's it. Over time, as I say, it's a cumbersome procedure to have all five chiefs, frequently two or three of them are not even in town. They're off trying to run their services and do their other chores. More and more, it just became the practice that I represented the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, despite what you may have heard to the contrary, my colleagues and I get along very well indeed, and we see eye to eye on much more than we disagree. fact, you've been accused of being too cozy on a thing on occasion. Insofar as the war in Southeast Asia is concerned, there hasn't been a divergency of view among the Joint Chiefs of Staff since the fall of 1964. So when I talked to the President or to the Secretary of Defense, I knew what the other chiefs' views were. But not only that, if a particular problem was coming up, I always consulted with them if I had time. If I didn't have time, or if I did for that matter, I always reported to them practically verbatim what went on at the meetings, what I had said, and if we were talking about a problem where there was a divergency of view among the chiefs, I would always express the divergent view. I made this a practice, and so that he was not receiving merely my advice. He was receiving the corporate advice of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
General, would this have the fact that you came to be the main contact among the Joint Chiefs, would it relate to the fact of your personal relationship developing with the President?
I don't think so, really. I think that I think this was a matter of convenience more than anything else. As I say, the cumbersomeness of trying to get five very busy men, four of whom have services to run together at a given time as compared to having one spokesman, namely myself, whose principal job it is to do this. You see, I don't have to run a service. I don't have to devote my time to that. I don't even run my aides, they run me. So I'll have to take that out.
General, on a sort of reflective basis over the last 4 years, 5 years really, is the military in the position of necessarily presenting the strongest military posture in an event? I'm not sure I'm making myself clear.
I don't think I followed you on that.
In a decision-making process, when the military chiefs are advising the President, do they necessarily always give the strongest military position? Do they advocate it?
No. As a matter of fact, what we try to do is to lay out for the President what the pros and the cons are of adopting any course of action. And having done that, we then come down and recommend what we think is right. And I might say that the rule that we try to follow is this. If I were President of the United States, would I follow the advice that is being presented to me? In other words, is it logical? Is it a dangerous course of action? Is it a necessary course of action? So that we don't by any manner of means advocate the strongest possible military response to a military situation that arises. For example, we never, during the whole course of the campaign against North Vietnam, advocated the use of nuclear weapons. We never advocated bombing the dikes in North Vietnam. We advocated a few other things that were too strong for people's stomachs, but not those two anyway, and there were others. In other words, we try to be sensible men.
I think what I'm reflecting is the feeling, in looking back, of the military developments in the 60s, you get the impression of, you know, we are committing and we are committing, and it was escalating, and you know, whether it was Southeast Asia or the South American hemisphere, and obviously the military would have to present the military point of view in these aspects. What would happen if we commit? How much we need in order to either succeed politically or militarily.
Right. For example, if you want to use the war in Southeast Asia as an example, it's a good one. In the summer of 1965, it became amply clear that it wasn't a matter of whether the North Vietnamese were going to win the war. It was just a question of when they were going to win. In May and June of that year, early June, a series of rather sharp, small battles north and northwest, northeast of Saigon, out of the 10 General Reserve Battalions, I think it was 10 or 12, I forgot which, of the South Vietnamese Army, the enemy destroyed 9 of them. 1, 2, 3, 4, right up like that. The Vietnamese military at that time were busily indulging in politics and not keeping their eye on their job, and the situation deteriorated very rapidly to the point where they were all holed up in their compounds and doing nothing against the enemy. The enemy practically had a free hand in South Vietnam. The question arose at that time as to whether or not we should commit our own ground forces to rectify the situation. And the pros and the cons of this, I assure you, were very thoroughly discussed. Because it wasn't just a matter of main ground forces. If you were going to move in there, it meant budget money, it meant diversion of resources of all kinds. It meant a commitment that was going to probably last for a considerable period of time. This couldn't be done overnight. And furthermore, if you're going to fight a war, you shouldn't fight it in South Vietnam. You'd better fight it in North Vietnam, because that's where the problem arose. In other words, they were the source. Now, President Johnson, on the 25th of July of 65, after consulting with all of his advisors, came to the conclusion that this was the proper course of action, that we had a commitment made by other presidents at other times, and so he made the decision to go ahead and move our forces in, which we did. Now,
there was also consideration about the call of the reserves, wasn't there?
That was discussed at the time. And we advocated the military for two reasons. One, we have never recommended or even considered it desirable to attempt to create particularly ground forces of sufficient size to meet all of our commitments worldwide. You would have a standing army that would just be tremendous in size if you did. For that reason, all of the services have reserve units. In the case of the Army and the Air Force, both National Guard and Reserve, and Army Reserve and Air Reserve. And all of our contingency plans were based upon the assumption that if we made a sizable commitment of our forces any place in the world, we would immediately reconstitute the strategic reserves of the United States by the call-up of reserve units. Now there's another aspect of this which is pertinent here from the military point of view. Confining yourself to the active forces alone to supply the manpower and not being able to call upon the very sizable reserves of manpower and units in the reserve components meant that you had to stretch your talent if the regular force is very, very thin. It meant that you had to increase the call-up for the draft by a substantial percentage. And it started, it would over time spread your leadership then. I'm speaking of both officers and non-commissioned officers. So it was for a composite of all of these reasons that we recommended that we initiate a reserve call-up, plus one other factor, which is psychological. And that is that we felt that it would be desirable to have a reserve call-up in order to make sure that the people of the United States knew they were in a war and not engaged in some two-penny military adventure, because we didn't think it was going to prove to be a two-penny military adventure by any matter. It was for the same reason that we advocated and continue to advocate such things as closing the port of Haiphong and really undertaking an air and naval campaign against North Vietnam that would teach them what war was all about. They wouldn't be so damn eager to indulge in one. Now, as I think you intimated, or at least questions, we, in my judgment, misused our naval and air power, with the result that the North Vietnamese were able to accommodate over time to what little destruction was, to the destruction that was caused. And with the help of the Russians and the East European satellites, to a lesser degree, the Chinese were able to maintain themselves and continue the war.
Reflectively, would the impact of not calling up the reserve be measured now as one of the greater mistakes?
No, I wouldn't say so. It made it very difficult at the outset. For about 2 years, the Army and the Air Force particularly were really scratching in order to maintain the forces in Southeast Asia at the strength that they should be. At the same time, keep a one-year rotation policy, which has proved to be a very great morale factor among the troops. In other words, they know they're going to go there for 1 year and then they come home. As I say, we're over that hump now. But for about a year and a half or 2 years, it was really touch and go. And one of the things that happened was that we had to draw down so substantially on what was left of the United States. We had to draw down on our NATO forces in order to get the replacements to go to Vietnam. We were using really the United States regular units and the NATO units in Europe as a replacement pool. And this is not a very desirable way to do business.
What would it was the president's main resistance to calling up the reserves?
I think that what it came down to was two things. One would be the disruption in the economy, and the other, the disruption of the lives of so many families by suddenly calling a large group of men to act and duty. And I think these were the two things that weighed mostly on his mind. I think I probably got him in reverse order, as a matter of fact, of importance as he looked at it.
You've already mentioned the Gulf of Tonkin, and in talking about decision-making process, let me just ask you if there was any provocation on our part for what happened in the Gulf of Tonkin.
No. We had a couple of destroyers that were in international waters, they've been doing this for some time, going up the coast of North Vietnam, but out in the, in fact, we even avoided going in closer than about 13 miles. They claim 12 miles as their territorial waters. We only claim 3, as you probably know. But we stayed outside of what their claim of territorial waters was. And they, now these I'm not trying to mislead you. These ships were equipped with electronic equipment so that we could keep an eye on the naval order of battle, the air order of battle, and so on in North Vietnam, and also pick up other interesting tidbits of information. So I don't regard this as a provocation any more than, unless you want to take it as a provocation, that we have a Soviet intelligence collector that sits right off the port of Charleston all the time. And we have another one that sits right off the runway in Guam. In fact, I've seen it myself. They stay outside of our territorial waters, which is 3 miles. Is that a provocation or is it?
Could you tell me a little bit about Mr. Johnson's reaction to and the development surrounding the Gulf of Tonkin incident?
Well, he was understandably upset and I think angry that our vessel had been attacked in the high seas. This is, by international law, an act of war. And he wanted us to examine very, very carefully what our response should be. And we agreed that we should undertake a retaliatory action, which we did. Now, there was no hesitation on my end, on his part. No thought that this was the wrong thing to do. On the contrary, he felt it was absolutely mandatory. Or otherwise, why we were in danger of having one of our vessels up there sunk, because these fellows had these guided missile destroyer. I mean, they launched torpedoes, you see, and a torpedo hitting a destroyer, well, you're liable to have it sink with all hands aboard.
Was the President satisfied with the adequacy of the information presented him?
Yes, absolutely. Or else he wouldn't have undertaken it.
There was no doubt in his mind.
No, absolutely not.
Was the military advocating at that point continuous bombing of North Vietnam?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. All we were interested in was maintaining surveillance, intelligence surveillance. See, that happened in August of 1964, if I remember correctly, with the 4th and the 5th.
Early August, sir.
Early August. No, we hadn't advocated at that time any such actions.
Well, of course, the military has contingency plans for these things, don't they?
We have contingency plans for everything, including Thailand. And we had contingency plans for that, too, of course. But having a plan and having the intent to carry it out are two entirely different things, and of course, you know.
In October of 64, and then I believe February of 65, of course, was the bombing of Ben Hoa and Pleiku. Did the military initially advocate bombing at the first, on the first occasion?
Yes, we did. And that was turned down at the time. There was a lot of discussion as to the desirability of doing it. But he was responding at that time. Final decision was made not to. Then followed the Pleiku incident, which, by the way, we lost a considerable. I've forgotten how many of our people got killed. There were a number of them who were killed and wounded. And so the decision was made to make a retaliatory attack.
What was the President's resistance in Bien Hoa?
If I remember correctly, we hadn't lost very much from the Bien Hoa attack. And also, too much time had elapsed to tie the two together. You couldn't make a clear connection between the two. In the Play Coup incident, this was not only a repetition of what had happened before, which made it a little more odious from our point of view, but we could respond within a reasonable length of time and tie the two together. And the attack was very deliberately made against an American installation, or installations, I should say.
Could you tell me a little bit about how that decision was arrived at in the initiating the bombing?
Well, as it happened, McGeorge Bundy and the late John McNaughton were in Vietnam at the time. And General Taylor was in our ambassador. And as I recall it, they came in from Saigon with a concerted recommendation from McGeorge Bundy, McNaughton, Ambassador Taylor, and General Westmoreland that we should undertake a retaliatory action at once. And this, now this was already being considered here, but I'm sure that the recommendation from the field had a considerable weight in causing the President to make the decision.
Could you tell me a little bit about, as the bombing of North Vietnam continued, and of course we did initiate some bombing pauses too in there, but there's so much written about the restriction on the sites and Mr. Johnson's continued management of the targets.
Well, you've got to recognize that there were at least three points of view that were expressed. One was the point of view of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which was that if you're sensible, you don't give the enemy an even break. I mean, war is not a game. And so we advocated militarily we should undertake the most sizable effort that we could against remunerative targets, excluding population as a target, because none of us believed in that at all. Close the port of Haiphong is the first major target, as a matter of fact, by mining and by destroying the docks and the other facilities there by bombing. Utilize our naval forces out there to help out in targets that were close to the shore. Then you had another viewpoint, which was advocated, wanted to give signals to the enemy. So this meant that we used a sort of an eyedropper approach to applying our power. This had no effect at all. As a matter of fact, all it did was permit the North Vietnamese to improve their defenses, get more assistance from the Soviets and from the Eastern European satellites. I think probably strengthened the will of Hanoi rather than the contrary. Now this was this was one of these political-military theories that people come up with who are not professionals. The third point of view was I would say it was more the political point. In other words, the undesirability of embroiling the Soviet Union and or the Chi-Coms in this mess. And so here you had the President presented with three viewpoints, and he chose the slow approach. And just a question of which line of advice he was going to take. And for his own reasons, he chose the slow approach rather than the one that we advocated.
Did the president ever... General, did the president ever discuss his 64 campaign position on the war in relationship to what developed in 65?
Never in any great detail with me. I think from remarks that he made from time to time that he felt there was nothing inconsistent with what he'd said during 1964 and what happened later on. The reason being that the situation had changed. And he felt, I think, very comfortable in his own mind that he had done the right thing in the light of the situation he was facing.
There is a lot of talk or material written about the fact that part of the president's credibility gap, if to use a current phrase, developed in 66 in relation to the military and the Secretary of Defense making such optimistic prognoses of the conclusion of the war. Could you tell me a little bit how that came about?
I can say one thing, that I don't recall any member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff ever making an optimistic prognosis. As a matter of fact, the other day, the Washington Post, on the editorial page, they had, I think it was the Washington Post, they had a list of quotations as long as your arm, going back over the years to these so-called optimistic, over-optimistic statements and so on. There was none, any member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. There were some political leaders. Mr. McNamara, for example, got himself upbraided on more than one occasion for coming back in 64, 65 and saying that we could start withdrawing our troops by Christmas, or words to that effect. And I might add that the chiefs were somewhat appalled that he had made any such statement, because it didn't look that way to us. But this light at the end of the tunnel business and that kind of thing, I think did cause trouble. Another problem was, I believe, that there was really a failure to tell the people in words of one syllable that they could understand that this was a war involving the security interests or the interests of the United States. I think that in true American fashion, we tried to put this on a very high plane, one man, one vote, and I don't think the citizens of Cook County would understand that. I'm not not trying to be invidious when I mention Cook County, but we've had our problems with that in the United States. Self-determination, I don't think this means much to the average man. Now, in simpler terms, and perhaps in more mundane terms, the American people understand things real well. I don't know how this came about. I have noticed that President Johnson, while he is extremely persuasive, extremely logical, and projects himself, his personality and his characteristics extremely well in a small group or in talking to someone alone, simply didn't come over well on TV and radio. At least this was my my thought, and I'm no expert on this, but people far more experienced than I felt the same thing.
Did you ever discuss this with the president?
No, I never did. His other advisors could take that one up with him. He has said so himself on occasion a couple of times. But rather humorously one day, or semi-humorously, said that he thought that he could go on TV and read the Lord's Prayer, and he would be criticized for it.
General, was there any confusion as to the nature of our commitment in this period from the introduction of ground troops in 65 through 68 in a review of the policy?
Well, the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, which was passed by the Congress, told the President to, this we'll have to refer to and get the exact word, but the sense of it was to use that force that was necessary to protect the freedom of South Vietnam. Or maybe they even made it broader than that, Southeast Asia. So as far as I was concerned, there was no doubt as to what the commitment was and what we should do on the military side to carry out what seemed to me to be an authorization probably constitutionally unnecessary, but actually passed by the Congress, which put the executive branch and the congressional branch in the same bed. So as I say, there was no confusion in my mind. There seemed to be a confusion in a lot of other people's minds, but not mine. Maybe I'm too simple.
Was the growing pressure on ending the war and the emergence of bodies of dissident opinion a factor in changing the outlook or the nature from a more military view to a more politically oriented conclusion?
That was a part of it, compounded by the fact that the Tet Offensive of 1968 was a tremendous victory for the North Vietnamese in the United States. Actually, it was a very substantial military defeat for them. They really got themselves creamed. But the way it was played in the press here created in the minds of the American people the same effect that the outcome of the first Battle of Bull Run did. There was more gloom and doom around Washington than somewhat. There's a very fine book written, by the way, called Reveille in Washington, which deals with Washington at the time of the Civil War, written by a lady, by the way, whose name I forget right now, Catherine something like that. It's an old book. But she describes the atmosphere here in Washington after the first Battle of Bull Run. And as I say, I was reminded of that during the Tet Offensive, the February-March period of 1968. Incidentally, I went out to Vietnam in the latter days of February toward the end of the Tet Offensive, and people were far calmer in Saigon than they were in Washington. However, it had a tremendous effect on the public. It had an effect on the leadership of the Congress. It had an effect, there's just no question about it, upon President Johnson. And it had a major effect on the incoming Secretary of Defense, Mr. Clifford. And it's my view that it was then, in fact, he says as much in his article in Foreign Affairs, that that he began to reassess his position and move to higher ground. I think that the sense of your question would have to be answered in the affirmative.
But that we were aiming for a military type of conclusion prior to that time? Or the use of military force to arrive at?
Not. It's only actually from the very outset. Let's go back on this one, Ms. McSweeney. In the first place, all wars end politically. War is a political act to start off with. A war doesn't make sense unless there's a political reason for it. I don't know of any war yet that's been fought without some political peg to hang it on. So that in any war you seek a political end, and political objective, and it ends in some sort of a political agreement or decision or compromise. Now, we never used, during the entire course of our military operations in Vietnam or in Southeast Asia, we have never used even a fraction of the military power that's available to us. Now, it happens to be my view that had we done so, the war would have been over 2 years ago. So that, to respond to your question, from the very outset, the objective was to achieve what I would call a political settlement of the war.
But by a military stalemate?
By proving to the North Vietnamese that they could not possibly take over South Vietnam by force. And I might add that we certainly approve that. They can't. But you don't win wars like that. No war has ever been won on defense, at least not in my reading of military history. So what it amounts to is that the North Vietnamese fought from the very outset and are still fighting a war all out. And we have fought a war with a fraction of the power that we can bring to bear.
I'd better stop here.